Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer series, and we're picking up with our reading of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. And if you remember, we're reading from homily 52, and we're picking up this evening on page 395 with a little heading there called A Difficulty. And Isaac has been speaking to us about knowledge and faith. And if you remember, he begins the homily with a rather stark statement of saying that knowledge is opposed to faith. And certainly seems like a negative thought when we first hear it. It's rather jarring. But as we've gone through, we've seen that Isaac doesn't have a negative view of human knowledge or even his place in our movement towards the faith, but that faith always will supersede what we can understand and know through the limits of our intellect and our understanding, that faith allows us to comprehend that which, in a sense, is incomprehensible through the powers of our own intellect, that in and through faith, God opens us up to come to an experience of him as he is in himself, that the knowledge that comes through that experience might be dark, but nonetheless it is real and true. And what we can come to experience then is something of the very life of God, and that is always going to exceed what we can come to see in and through our observation of the things of this world, or simply through the gift of our own reasoning. And he brings us to look at it from a different angle tonight, and in particular through what he calls the three intelligible degrees which knowledge ascends and descends: body, soul, and spirit. And so he's going to take us through each of these, how it is that we come to know things through our senses, how we come to know things through our intellect and understanding, and then finally how we come to see and understand things in and through our faith. And so hopefully this will help bring things, make things a little bit clearer for us, as well as to show us the personal implications of this for us in terms of the living out of our life. And so we'll pick up, as I said, on page 395, about halfway down the page. But if any says, if all these good things and the aforementioned works of virtue, the abstention from evils, the discernment of the subtle thoughts that sprout up in the soul, the battle with thoughts, the struggle against the inciting passions, and the rest of such things without which even faith itself cannot manifest its power in the soul's actions, if it is knowledge that accomplishes all these good things, then how can knowledge be considered to be opposed to faith? So there is a kind of knowledge that he's already acknowledged that comes through the ascetical disciplines, that we come to see and understand certain truths about ourselves, but also God, and we could then make that step into faith. So how then can he make such a radical statement as he did at the beginning of the homily, that the two are opposed? And that's what he begins to address here in the following paragraphs. We say that there are also three intelligible degrees in which knowledge ascends and descends, and according to the variation of the modes wherein it walks, it submits to change and becomes the cause of either harm or help. There are three degrees: body, soul, and spirit. And although knowledge is single in its nature, yet it becomes more gross and more subtle and changes its provisions and the activities of its conceptions in relation to the noetic and sensible realms. And so the noetic realm, if you remember, they use the word nous to refer to what is often translated in the text, intellect or mind. Might be more adequately translated the eye of the heart, the eye of the soul, that through purification, through prayer and the ascetical life comes to be able to see in and through faith and gain this knowledge of God through contemplation. And so in relation to these noetic and sensible realms, so as there's this movement from the senses through ascetical practices to faith, we move from a more gross knowledge to a more refined knowledge, is what he's beginning to tell us here. So hearken and learn the order of its activity and causes whereby it either harms or helps. Knowledge is a gift bestowed by God on the nature of rational beings at their very creation. It is naturally simple and undivided, even as the light of the sun. But according to its activity, knowledge undergoes changes and divisions. So again, not a negative view of knowledge, that this is something with which we've been created, that God has given to us, faculty through which we come to understand the truths of this world, and also in and through which we are brought to that point of then coming to the faith. And so he begins with the first degree of knowledge in the following paragraphs. When knowledge cleaves to the love of the body, it gathers up the following provisions: wealth, vainglory, honor, adornment, rest of the body, special means to guard the body's nature from adversities, assiduity in rational wisdom, such as is suitable for the governance of the world, and which gushes forth the novelties of inventions, the arts, sciences, doctrines, and all other things which crown the body in this visible world. Among the properties of this knowledge belong those that are opposed to faith, which we have stated and enumerated above. This is called common knowledge, for it is naked of all concern for God, and because it is dominated by the body, it introduces into the mind an irrational impotence, and its concern is totally for this world. So a common knowledge that we've spoken before of being in a constant state of receptivity in and through our senses. And we are always perceiving and taking into ourselves what it is that we see and come to understand through that observation. And because this is rooted in the body and the senses, it's always going to be tied to pursuing those things that we feel that we need in order to provide for ourselves, to sustain ourselves, to build our world, or to invent new things, or as he says, even art itself. And yet, he tells us that this can be opposed to the knowledge that comes through faith, because we can get tied into this kind of knowledge where we have no concern for God whatsoever, that we're only and solely directed towards the things of this world in the pursuit of them and the protection of them for ourselves, that we give no thought to God through the practice of the ascetical life, through prayer. At this point, if we're driven only by our senses, by our bodily needs, that's what we're going to seek. And so it's, in this sense, it's clearer as to how he makes the distinction here, or why he would say that knowledge is opposed to faith. That if our vision is constantly focused upon the things of this world, it's never going to be directed towards the things of God or be seeking God. And I don't think it's a stretch for us to see how that's true. Even for us as men and women of faith, we often will regress when we're going through trials or difficulties, or we're under mental strain. We'll again turn our vision towards the things of this world, desperately looking for something to satisfy us, to fulfill us, to protect us in some fashion or another. And we can, in the process, lose sight of God. We cease seeking after him, and we seek our safety. We seek our meaning only in what we can see and experience or touch, or what we can experience through our senses. And you know, without living the ascetical life, as we've spoken of so often, it's easy for us to be pulled right back to this kind of experience of our life, that we have a longing for a sense of fulfillment, of a sense of satisfaction, and if our passions are disordered also then by our sin, that we're going to constantly be seeking ways to gratify them, and we can end up losing sight of God altogether. And so this is why he would hold it forth, at least at this point in the reading, as something that is opposed to faith. So any thoughts so far on this first paragraph? So just to keep in mind, it's naked of all concern for God. So there's no thought of God at all in the individual who's only driven by this common knowledge, or only seeks to live through this common knowledge. The measure of knowledge does not reckon that there is any noetic power and hidden steersman over a man whatsoever, nor any divine care that shelters and takes concern for him. That phrase, inner steersman, would be good to circle. I mean, it's often how the noose is described. The helmsman of a ship, if you will, is provided it's been purified through prayer and the ascetical life, it's able to guide and direct us through this life toward God. And so this, for a person who has no sense of a noetic power or this hidden steersman within us, they're going to be driven only by the passions and the senses. It takes no account of God's providential governance, but on the contrary, it attributes to a man's diligence and his methods every good thing in him, his rescue from what harms him, and his natural ability to avert the plights and many adversities that secretly and manifestly accompany our nature. So oblivious of God, he can come to see himself then the source of providence. It's by his own efforts, his own diligence, that he's going to build up his life or protect himself from the natural realities of this world that come upon us in an unsuspecting way. And you could see if a person is driven only by this kind of knowledge, they're also going to be driven, as he said earlier in the homily, by a certain sense of anxiety, that we're always going to be confronted with those unexpected things in this life that stand as a threat to our happiness. And so if we have no sense of God or of God's providence, and we're only looking to care for ourselves or our loved ones, then we're constantly going to be driven by distraction, or we're going to become angry at others who seem to be a threat to that security, our security within this world. So you have a sense here of where he's leading us. Not that you have to agree with him, but okay.
It actually made me think of Veronius's prayer, asking St. Philip to be the steersman, really right. Steer this little ship of life.
Steer this little ship.
It's actually really interesting. I don't know if it's what he said as much or how you explained it there, but it's like, it's funny because what you said there, even if it's good or it can seem good, like mm-hmm. trying to take care of all the things mm-hmm. in your life, that's like what we're kind of told on a day. You know what I mean? Like go to work and make sure you're contributing to your 401k and you're building up and you're putting yourself and you're, even if it's your family, you're putting all these things first, but you're not, you know what I mean? You're not, you have no trust in that. You're putting everything in yourself.
Yeah, and in so many ways too, like insurance policies play on that. I mean, it's that natural fear that we have that we're going to find ourselves wanting, or we're going to leave those we love wanting. And so we need to find ways to protect ourselves and them, and we'll pay exorbitant monthly fees in order to do so. And you know, it's, I think, a difficult and painful thing for most of us. And even it can touch upon our life of faith, that what on the surface looks like faith can actually be more of a fire insurance for us, that God can be exactly what he's describing here. Well, I'm going to embrace a kind of faith that is really, again, as we've talked about before, sort of a construct of the mind in order to protect myself from the fears of the things that I face on a day-to-day basis in this world. And so I might engage even in certain religious practices, but what they give us, a kind of psychological relief and free us from this kind of fear where we're really focused only on the things of the world. And so we treat God as sort of the protector of our goods. And if we're a good person in a certain way, or if we say certain prayers, we live a certain kind of life, then we are going to be blessed. It's sort of the basis of the prosperity gospel, I would think that if we, you know, act in a certain kind of way, then, you know, we're going to be blessed with good fortune in this world.
It's interesting because, like, what he's describing in this paragraph right here, it seems like it would actually be slightly less dangerous than to actually be living this and believing this, but saying that you, like, believe in God and like, having a sort of minimal kind of religious... Because then, like, you're going to have all the anxiety of trying to run your own life. And all the anxiety of trying to know and control everything and all the failure that comes with that. And yet you've convinced yourself somehow, to some degree, in your head that God is there and that you have invited him in. And now look at the state of your life and what a mess it is. It'd almost be better if, like, you just didn't actually think or act as if he was there at all, because then at least you wouldn't, like, blame him or think there was something dysfunctional.
That's right. It's sort of like having all the bases covered. Mm-hmm. And I think this is why the cross is the, and always will remain, the stumbling block of Christianity. Because our faith in God and our relationship with him, our prayer life, is not something that protects us from the cross and suffering. And so often we can approach the faith life in that way, and we can become resentful towards God when we find ourselves drawn intimately into the cross in our lives through various kinds of suffering. Okay. He goes on to say, this degree of knowledge presumes that all things are by its own providence, like those men who assert that there is no divine governance of visible things. Nevertheless, it cannot be without continual cares and fear for the body. Therefore, it is a prey to faint-heartedness, sorrow, despair, fear of the demons, trepidation before men, and rumor of thieves, and the report of murders, anxiety over diseases, concern over the want and lack of necessities, fear of death, fear of sufferings, of wild beasts, and of other similar things that make this knowledge like a sea made turbulent by great waves at every hour of the night and day. So it's like watching Fox News 24 hours of the day, that we are constantly bombarded by all these horrendous tragedies that can do only one thing, that agitate the mind and the heart. And you know, I would even go so far as to say is to be overly attentive to those things weakens our faith. It's like assaulting ourselves over and over again, and putting our faith to the test, as it were. We're taking our eyes off of God with this sense of wanting to know what's going on in the world. And so we have these 24/7 news channels, and we're told that we somehow have to stay tuned in to everything that's going on in the world. And because they have to maintain that 24/7 cycle, they're focused on every possible negative thing that happens in the world that we would have never heard about before in the past that we wouldn't have had access to. And the fact that we're confronted with every single thing, I think, is part of the reason that we see such, you know, heightened anxiety within our world, that people are terrified by what's going on and to become more and more anxious and angry. And, you know, we see, you know, greater and greater disunity among people, and, you know, party spirit begins to develop because we need to protect ourselves against the other, you know, who can, you know, draw us down a certain path that leads to our destruction. For knowledge does not know how to cast its care upon God through the confident trust of faith in Him. Wherefore, in all things that concern it, it is constantly engaged in devising devices and clever contrivances. But when in some instance the modes of its contrivances prove fruitless, it strives with men as though they hindered and opposed it, since it does not see in this the mystical hand of providence. So, you know, we work very hard to come up with ways to protect ourselves from everything that we possibly can. Others, from diseases, you know, anything possibly that could be a threat to us. And when those things fail, we still don't, you know, if we're locked into the state, still don't turn to God. And so we have to find a scapegoat, someone to blame for that, who somehow hindered our purpose or opposed it by what they did do or didn't do. And so it sort of pits us against each other then, as well as filling us with a kind of anxiety. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, the true tree that uproots love, is planted in this very knowledge. It investigates the minute faults of other men and the causes thereof and their weaknesses. And it arms a man for stubbornly upholding his opinion, for disputation, and aids him in cunningly employing devices and crafty machinations and other means which dishonor a man. In this knowledge are produced and are found presumption and pride, for it attributes every good thing to itself and does not refer it to God. So this is what I was saying, you know, it pits us so quickly against each other and makes us scrutinize each other, and in particular what we would perceive as the weaknesses in each other, the faults and the failings. And so we seek that, as we've talked so often before, we seek that position of emotional power as well as physical power over the other. That in the end, this is the only way that we can protect ourselves, that in relationships we have to, you know, be crafty in such a way that we remain in emotional control of the other. Otherwise, we're going to feel diminished in one form or another. And this is why so many relationships would break apart, or why they become toxic, because they're controlling. And there's a lack of trust and love, and certainly trust in God that guides them. And again, you know, it fills us with a kind of presumption and pride, because we are referring everything back to ourselves. We become the center and source of everything. There's a kind of profound arrogance in this, because we're viewing everything within this world, everything that we experience and every other person in relation to ourselves and the effect that it has upon ourselves. So I find this incredibly astute. I mean, it's like Isaac is describing everything that is taking place in the 21st century, the way that we view reality and the way that we experience reality. I mean, psychologically, I mean, I think he really captures in a profound way the movements of the mind and the heart. Any thoughts or comments on these first couple of paragraphs?
Well, it reminds me of the Garden of Eden, and you have that tree of knowledge, and Satan tempting Adam and Eve. It's, we receive these temptations all the time.
Right. Like. Well, that's what he's alluding to here, exactly. That, eat for yourself, your eyes will be open, and you will know for yourselves good and evil, and you will be like gods. Yeah. And so this is exactly, Isaac isn't straying from what the scriptures reveal to us. What he's doing is illuminating what they say in a profound way, that, we are making ourselves God, and in the process, we lose control of ourselves completely. And we see this in Adam and Eve. They want to become like gods, but as soon as they take that path, they succumb to the temptation. They all of a sudden, their vision of reality changes, and they're filled with shame. They can't look at themselves or each other in the same way anymore. They have to cover themselves, and then they have to hide themselves from God. Even God becomes a threat. Their very creator becomes a threat to them. And so everything begins to fall apart for them, because they would seize for themselves, what is found in God alone. That somehow we can provide providentially for ourselves. We can anticipate every end for ourselves. And think about that. When we get anxious, I found this, from seminary on and through the first years of my priesthood, whenever I would get anxious about all the work that I would have to do and everything that was before me, I'd think about finding myself a better calendar. It's called Franklin Covey now. It used to be the Franklin Planner, where you would plan out your whole day and you would, A, B, C, you would sort of categorize things by their priority and what was most important, and then you would check off as you went through and did everything. And at the end of the day, you'd have this sense, wow, I really accomplished a lot. But a few months into it, you begin to think, holy cow, my whole life is controlled by this calendar and this sense that it gives me of being in control, that if I'm accomplishing all these tasks, all is going to be well and nothing is going to fall through the cracks. And yet, in the end, it proves itself to be an illusion, and it creates its own anxiety for us, that our life is suddenly being controlled by something as stupid as a calendar. Any other thoughts?
Yes.
I think we all do that, though. We all have to have our calendars, and we have to check to make sure that this particular day is open, mm-hmm. or we're just busy, busy, busy.
Right, right. And checking for texts that we don't miss any, or emails that we don't miss any contact from a person. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, with the story of Adam and Eve, it was the two of them, and it was pretty, what was happening was very obvious, but for all of us, we're in the midst of millions of people, and it doesn't seem so clearly defined. I mean, I can remember thinking, looking at grown-ups when I was a kid and thinking, this is really contrary to what catechism is about. but coming to this realization, like, it must be all right, though, to not really take it so serious and literal, to go with the flow.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think, we do experience a lot of unhappiness in life. And we get to a point where we have to try to hide it from ourselves in order that not to experience the kind of depression and dejection because of it. And so we will frame our lives in a certain way to convince ourselves that we're doing what is necessary, what is good, and even what we think will ultimately bring us and others happiness. And yet in the end, I think most of that is formed by what the culture and the world around us is telling. It's not something that we are discovering in and through our relationship of intimacy with God. And we talked about this one night, a movie on St. Francis of Assisi, and I was struck by, he's being hounded by his friends because he's thrown, he's given everything away, and he's living in poverty, and he's rebuilding this broken down church. And, to one of his friends in this movie, He says, Francis, I want to help you. And he says, Bernardo, words. I used to believe in words, but not anymore. And at one point he says, I just want to be happy. Not in the sense of, you know, as a child would want to be happy, but as a child of God would want to be happy, the sense of being loved and being free from anxiety and free from the distress that we hear spelled out for us so clearly in these paragraphs, the portrait or the painting that Isaac puts before our eyes of this life with no clear concern for God at all, that it leaves us in that kind of quiet desperation. And we have to do all kinds of things to convince ourselves that, okay, this is what life is all about. And so, you know, this is why people like Tony Robbins and all those guys make tons of money, because they're sort of they're life coaches, you know, giving people newer ways to sort of try to shape their reality and their destiny. And I shouldn't be amused by it, but one of these things that Tony Robbins had, you know, his people walk on hot coals, and there was this big, you know, scandal and blow up about it because some of the people at the conference tried to walk across those coals in with bare feet, and they all burned the bottom of their feet, and, you know, ambulances had to be brought in to take the people to the hospital. You know, he was trying to coach them to this point where, you know, they could rise above the limitations of their nature by this, you know, power of positive thinking. And, you know, it's so, you know, if we have that emptiness, void, or unhappiness, we're always going to seek to fill that void in some way or find a way to convince ourselves that we've lifted ourselves out of it, that by our own strength, by being the source of providence, that we've, you know, through hard work and diligence, have found a way to be successful in this world, be successful in life.
Okay. Who is Tony Robbins?
Well, he's sort of a contemporary author, public speaker, life coach. You know, he gives these like retreats, secular retreats of showing people how to live their lives to the fullest. He's not so well known. I guess he sort of slipped out of the public, you know.
Yeah, I haven't heard from him.
He's on Netflix.
Yeah. He was noted. What was going on? Some crisis, some God event, weather crisis, and he was not allowing people into his church to escape the flooding or the elements or something.
Oh, right, yeah.
So last I heard of him.
Yeah. Is he an evangelical?
Well, I don't know what his faith beliefs are, you know, if he's a Christian or if he's a man of faith at all. But, you know, I think, you know, it's just more, again, sort of like a secular religion kind of thing.
Collector of fine cars.
What's that?
He's a collector of fine cars.
Yeah, and I don't want to turn this into a critique of, you know, Tony Robbins, but I think it is expressive of what Isaac is saying here, that we'll do just about anything. And people pay huge amounts of money, like political leaders, government leaders and you know, movie stars, you know, all will pay him huge amounts of money in order to coach them so that they can continue to be successful in their life or make good decisions, at least in their own minds.
I've listened to something that sounds very opposite than of all that recently. It was that you've called it out before, is that blog, it's called Glory to God for All Things, and there was a podcast on it. It's just interesting, right? Because it, in contrast to trying to control your own perception of reality, he was talking about how, like, I really can't remember the details. There was some story he was talking about, a saint saying, like, I didn't understand, but have your mind in hell, but something. And he was telling the story about how, like, that wasn't meant for most people. And the opposite, but the thing that was, like, offered is, everyone could do was to give glory, like praise, to continuously offer up praise to God. And that in that it was like the same thing. So it just sounds different than, right? Like trying to control your reality, so to say, to just accept your reality.
Right. That was a recent post. It's Father Stephen Freeman. Tremendous writer, and he captures that beautifully, I think, in saying, you know, that gratitude is the way that we lift ourselves out of that, because we direct our minds and our hearts to God, that we give him thanks for what we've, you know, we received, and for, you know, his love and care in the midst of giving us strength and to persevere in and through the trials and the sufferings that we do endure. Not from necessarily lifting us out of them, but, you know, giving us hope in the midst of them. And that the gratitude takes the focus off of ourselves and places it where it should be, onto God. So he is a very fine writer. Father Stephen Freeman actually gives some thought into what he writes, which is hard to find on the internet. Okay, I think we're at the paragraph that begins faith. Oh, the tree. No, we did that, didn't we? Okay. We did that, right? Yeah. We did that. We're at the paragraph faith. Faith, however, attributes its works to grace. For this reason, it cannot be lifted up with pride. As it is written, I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me, and again, not I, but the grace of God which was with me. And also, knowledge puffeth up, which the blessed apostle said of the same knowledge, since it is not mingled with faith and hope in God, but he said it is not concerning true knowledge, far be it. And so, you know, faith is always going to acknowledge that it's by the grace of God that we're able to do what it is that we do in this world, or whatever crosses that we might carry are not carried by our own strength or by the power of our own will, but only by the gift that we receive from God. So sort of coming back to Daniel's point, you know, in Freeman's article, this sense of gratitude to God allows us to direct our thoughts where they need to be directed, and away from the sense of our having providential control of our own lives. By humility, true knowledge makes perfect the soul of those who have acquired it, like Moses, David, Isaiah, Peter, Paul, and the rest of the saints who have been accounted worthy of this perfect knowledge to the degree possible for human nature. And by diverse theorias and divine revelations, and by the lofty vision of spiritual things, and by ineffable mysteries and the like, their knowledge is swallowed up at all times, and in their own eyes they reckon their soul to be dust and ashes. So this knowledge of God, this vision of God, allows them to freely acknowledge their own mortality, that they are dust and ashes, and that they have life and being only in and through God. And it's their faith in He who is the source of life and love and the governor of history that frees them from all anxiety, that they can acknowledge freely that they are dust, they are nothing, that it's God alone who keeps them in, who's given them life and who will preserve that life. And the more perfect that faith becomes, the more clearly they see that truth. Did you have a question?
Mm-hmm. Why would he say the soul is dust and ashes? The body is dust and ashes.
Well, it's the distinction that he's making here, body, soul, and spirit. So within the soul, he would see things like intellect, imagination, memory, reason, understanding. You know, all those things that are good, but in the end, they are ashes as well. They cannot bring us to where we want to go, and they cannot reveal to us only what God can reveal to us in and through the gift of faith. So he's making, in a sense, it's very you know, if I didn't know better, I'd say John of the Cross stole what Isaac is writing here, because it's this tripart view of the human person, body, soul, and spirit. And as it's articulated here, it's very similar to how John of the Cross articulates things, that he even says that, you know, there is this dark night of the senses, the soul, where all those things that come to us through understanding, reason, imagination, fall away. They're limited. We have to let go of our grip on them in order to be drawn along by something greater, by faith. And that's a very difficult thing for us to do, because we find that in that a kind of sense of security in what we understand, by our own ability. It might be higher than what we come to see and understand in and through our senses, but it's still always going to be radically limited. And so even with what proves to be fruitful for us, especially when ordered through the ascetic life, is eventually, it might bring us up to that point of faith, but it's always going to be limited by our own limits as human beings. That no matter how profound our understanding of God might be, or what we might hold in our mind through our reflection, even upon the scriptures, it's always going to be less than God. It's not going to be God as he is in himself. It's always going to be our projection of something, even no matter how refined that might be, that understanding might be. It's always going to be something that's pretty radically limited.
So the spirit is what we used to call the soul, but because I never learned that it was always body and soul, and the soul is the part that lives on.
John of the Cross describes the spirit as the higher level of the soul. So he still has, you know, makes the distinction between body and soul, but the first level of the soul would be these things, our rational faculties, and spirit would be that which we come to contemplate God. But let's let Isaac see if he can sort of help us understand it. I'll muddy the waters, I think, if I try to guide us through this. Okay, any other comments or questions before we move on? Okay, go ahead.
I'm just guessing confused, because I have a few knowledges, like I know how to read or write, or I know biology. So I don't see how that's related to this. Or is he not describing knowledge in that sense?
No, he is. And he's even describing it in terms of what we would think as the faith life. That, you know, that through our practice of asceticism, vigils, prayer, reading of the scriptures, that we can come to perceive and understand certain things, but always within the confines of our reason, our understanding, our intellect. But that is always going to be something limited. So in the next section, he's still talking to us here about what comes, you know, guiding our life only through what comes through the senses, and we give no concern to God at all. We're still discussing that. He's going to get into the second degree of knowledge here in another page or so. But again, he's not saying that, you know, there's a certain kind of knowledge that comes of the world through the senses. And there's a certain kind of knowledge that comes even of God through creation itself, and through what has been revealed to us through the study of scriptures. He'll talk about that. But even these things, he will tell us, are ultimately limited. Like John of the Cross, he'll say, you know, to know God as he is in himself, that it's only through faith, which is a knowing, a dark, obscure knowing, but nonetheless arises through experience of God himself. And to enter into that, we have to be willing to let go of even what has carried us along and maybe even brought us to the point of faith. Because of its limitations. It's not because it's evil, it's because of its, you know, its limits. But faith offers us something far greater, which is intimacy with the triune God and the capacity to contemplate God as he is. And yet how we experience that is going to be radically different than what we experience through our senses or than what we experience through the use of our own reason. Okay. So just, you know, we have to be a little patient here, let him draw us along, but hopefully things will become a little clearer for us as we make our way through. Okay. What time are we at here? Okay. But that other knowledge is puffed up, even as is meet, since it walks in darkness and values that which belongs to it by comparison with things of earth, and it knows not that there is something better than itself. And so all who cling to such knowledge are seized by the uplifting of pride, because they measure their discipline according to the standard of the earth and the flesh. They rely upon their works, and their minds do not enter into incomprehensible matters. But as many as reflect upon the waves of the glorious splendor of the Godhead, and whose labor is on high, their minds do not turn aside with inventions and vain thoughts. For those who walk in the light cannot go astray. And for this reason, all those who have strayed from the light of the knowledge of the Son of God and have turned away from the truth journey in these pathways just mentioned. This is the first degree of knowledge. In it, man follows the desire of the flesh. We find this knowledge blameworthy and declare to be opposed not only to faith, but to every working of virtue. And so, you know, being so radically limited in our understanding of the human person, our life in this world, the way that we view things, that we shut out the idea that of seeking to enter into that which is incomprehensible to the mind, that we radically limit ourselves, including the practice of any virtue. And, you know, I think often people will, you know, question the value and the significance of faith. You know, why can't I just be a good person? Or they'll point to certain individuals within the world who live a virtuous life in the way that we would understand that as human beings, a kind of natural virtue. You know, they are charitable. You know, they give to others. There's a kind of humility even there that they possess. But what Isaac is saying is that in and through faith, we're called not just to be good people or even reach the heights of this natural virtue, but what we're called to is a participation in the life and the perfection of God. Be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, or you will be perfect. It's couched in the future indicative. You will be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. That this is what we are called to, you know, deification. And I think this is where the, you know, East makes things, you know, has a greater clarity about that, that I think we off in the West will fall into a kind of moralistic approach to religion, a kind of legalism, a kind of Puritanism, perhaps, and lose sight of that which is greater. You know, and the reason we fall into those things is because we lose sight that we are, have been created for God, and that our full experience of ourselves as human beings and the way that God has created us is to live in intimacy with Him and to share in His life. It's not some notion that we have created with our own minds of what perfection would look like. And we often do that. You know, we, even as Christians, you know, we have in our minds what we think the good Christian life looks like. But that doesn't mean that that's in accord with the mind of God. You know, most of us would probably find those who are saints to be irritating because of the way that they live and love and the way that they view reality, that their very being would often challenge our perception of things. You know, we often will create this like plaster statue image of the saints, Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, that really refined image, statue image that we have of her, but, you know, it's often far from what the reality was. I saw, okay, Carol, you haven't asked.
What do you mean by annoying? Like, what would be the traits that we would find?
Well, I think what we might accept as benign, or what even what we might think is in accord with the will of God, or what we might see as prayerful, you know, or the kind of prayer that God would be calling us to, or the kind of self-gift or self-emptying, that there would be something that goes beyond the limits of our understanding and is maybe a bit frightening. You know, somebody like, you know, think of in the West, maybe like Padre Pio or John Vianney, even for a priest, thinking of them spending 16 hours a day in the confessional. It's like, my goodness, I spend an hour in the confessional and you think you're spent after that. And you think the grace of, you know, of being able to live their life that way, or the depth of prayer, Philip Neri in the catacombs praying all night long, immersing himself in the depths of that silence, or, you know, of those saints who, you know, fasted and really embraced the ascetical life in a powerful way, you know, embrace, you know, the life of vigils. We can make them in our own minds into kind of fanatics, those who are out at the extreme or the margins, not a reflection, an icon of the life that God has called us to. And so something that we would seek, you know, not a mirror for us to look at ourselves in, but rather something that, you know, is so highly exalted that we, you know, have no way of connecting with them. And so they can seem, you know, like obscure figures to us, that we can't really wrap our minds around them, even as we admire them or hold them up. You know, and, you know, when Christ criticizes the Pharisees, you know, you build the temples to the prophets that your fathers murdered, you know, and we build the temples of the, you know, the martyrs of our own faith, you know, the churches, you know, that bear their name. And yet in the way that we live our lives, we in reality mock and reject what their lives bear witness to, that we turn away from it, and instead of allowing it to be that which guides and directs our lives, that shines a light for us. Where did I leave off here? Can somebody help me out? Okay. Oh, so we finished that paragraph. Okay. So where are we standing here? Well, it's 8:30, so we're not going to enter into the next one. But so, you know, be patient here. You know, we've only gone through the first that he's describing. And, you know, I think we could go back over this dozens of times and really catch a reflection of our own life and the way that we will often regress in the path of faith to this, you know, especially in those times when we were feeling particularly insecure in our lives. And so this, just going back over this one section would be a good meditation, especially as we approach something like Lent and are really thinking about conversion. You know, we will often take the minimalist approach to Lent, you know, letting go of certain sweets and things like that. But I think if we were to try to read Isaac and look at this as a call to a greater self-abandonment to God, it would bear much more fruit for us, I think. Okay. Any final comments or questions, concerns? Yes.
Well, I thought what was extremely helpful was the sentences on what is at the root of the way of us striving with others so greatly. I was struck recently, I was watching this British documentary on crime. It's really interesting. One of the things it was saying is most of the times that we almost always associate crying with being hurt, but it's actually what's going off in the brain is so much more often frustration. And that really struck me, because frustration is that I wanted something or I wanted to do something that was thwarted. So we could say, like, frustrate your plans. I was frustrated in my attempt for this or my desire for that. So if it's frustration, if that's the emotion really, then that thing that's happening all the time is something got in my way, in the way of this thing or that thing. And I think when we speak about others, it's more often like, I'm so frustrated with this person, or so they're so frustrating. And I know myself and most people I speak to, they never say like, oh, I'm so hurt by that person. They're just like, I can't stand that person, you know? And it's really that feeling of frustration. I found that really helpful. But in the greater context of this whole passage, what I found really striking and really disturbing is that it was basically kind of like reading my own behavior. And then he's like, and the people who do this are the people who don't actually believe there's a God and don't account God for anything. And I'm like, okay. Like, oh, that's great.
Yeah, I think there's actually a little picture of you here in the next page.
Yeah, probably.
Little sketch. Isn't that you on the next?
It's really kind of extraordinary. You know, like, you're not expecting to recognize yourself in the thing where it's, we take no account of God's existence at all in the way we act or behave or in the knowledge we rely on for our day-to-day life. You're like, oh, well, I know I won't find myself at 3, but maybe 2. And then you're like, oh, no, here I am at 1. And it's really humbling, but again, a really good point for reflection. Yeah. Because it's like, okay, well.
Yeah, the Syriac word for frustration is lore and...
My name means the victorious one.
Yeah. If that makes you feel good, okay. Okay, well, we close here and we'll pick up next week. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your
spirit. May God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
Thank you all.